This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And S. Brian Wilson, a longtime peace activist, among others. An insider's account of Guantanamo will take place at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in downtown Portland. Thursday, August 1st, doors open at 6:30 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com.
Welcome to Radio Zine. I'm Ren Green, and today I'm speaking with Portland animator Kathy Hart about her short film, Torn.
How do you describe your film?
I'd say that Torn is an experimental animation that uses rotoscoping techniques to capture some indexicality of human erratic dance to describe my response to... Sorry.
It's okay.
It makes me cry.
Your film is about eugenics.
Yes, it is.
In Native American populations.
Specifically addressing Native American women in the 50s, 60s, and into the early 70s. But it addresses a much broader audience, and a global audience, where eugenics is still practiced around the world in insidious ways that we're really unaware of. And I think we could stand to have some attention brought to the matter so that we can review what eugenics means. It's not a dead political practice at all.
And what sparked your interest in making a film about eugenics in Native American populations?
The moment that sparked this film for me was the day after the last election, and we'd all voted. We're sitting around the table at school having a class. And the professor asked if we had all voted. And one of the people sitting at the table said she had not voted. And I asked her why. You can not vote. That's fine if you can justify your position on not voting. But this 21-year-old girl who is Native American Latino, who was not voting on reproductive rights, just made me so mad.
How did you become aware of these particular eugenics practices?
At the beginning of the project, I had asked myself, what do reproductive rights mean to me? And then I posed that question to my peer group. And a friend of mine responded with a link to a scholarly article about Native American genocide and the action it took to begin the process to stop it. So I was made aware of it by a friend of mine who thought it was a valid concern.
And in these practices, they forcibly sterilized young women without their consent or knowledge. And the narrator in your film did not learn until she was married and ready to start a family that she couldn't.
Correct.
And this went on until the 1970s.
On paper, it went on until the early 70s, but in my research, I learned that it continued on until the early 80s. And the Oregon Board of Eugenics, their last compulsory sterilization in 1981.
And who made these decisions?
Honestly, I didn't look into the very specific details, but I understand that it was a judge in the 50s who determined that this population was a burden on on society.
What is the value of looking at eugenics practices from the 40s, from the 50s, from the 60s? What's done is done.
I don't think so. Our reproductive rights are still up for discussion for some reason. I cannot really wrap my head around why we're still talking about bodily rights in 2013, and particularly reproductive rights. Whose business is it but a woman or a family's to have children or not have children?
What's happening in the American landscape right now? It's like, make up your minds. We didn't want this population reproducing, and now we're giving women in many states no choice.
No choice.
Will have that child, whether you like it or not. You will care for that child, whether you want them or not. Frightening.
It's terrifying. And that birth control is up for discussion, abortion is up for discussion, that the invasive diagnosis process that is currently in practice to determine whether somebody's pregnant or not is completely invasive. The government having any portion of control over women's reproductive rights, or even men's for that matter, is absurd.
I studied computer animation in the mid-90s at the Rochester Institute of Technology, and there was a lot of pressure on students to make entertaining films or to make cartoons. And I was often asked, well, you must love cartoons. Don't you love cartoons because you're an animator? Most people don't see animation as being some sort of political statement. Is it common at the Pacific Northwest College of Art for students to make films that mean something?
Absolutely. The animated arts department at Pacific Northwest College of Art is definitely directed by experimental film installation animation. There's very little push to do character animation. People do character animation, that's for sure, and people love it and enjoy it. But when we're asked to make work, it is imperative that we approach it with passion. And whatever that passion is for you is what's going to drive the thousands of drawings and, or the many, many, many hours of computer time to make a film.
You better be committed.
You have to be committed. You have to be in it.
What brought you to animation in particular as an art form?
I used to be a photographer, or I'm still a photographer, but I was a photo major. And during critical theory classes, we were studying visual studies and reviewing how the photo has served and continues to serve through time as a device to objectify people. And I looked to other art forms that I could engage in that didn't objectify. But I was so put back by how photography has served that I decided that I really needed a break and to step back and look at my own practice as a photographer and how could I go forward without using people or using their image to create the work that I'm interested in creating. I had taken some drawing for animation classes at another school, and through that class I saw things like Norman McLaren's work, which is the Center for Visual Music in Los Angeles, has a website that shows a lot of Norman McLaren's work. And it's very musical, and it's in rhythmic and colorful, and it lacks any character figures. It's totally non-figurative.
For people who are listening, Norman McLaren was the National Film Board of Canada rock star who developed all sorts of innovative processes, including drawing directly on film. And he made a lot of PSAs for the Canadian government. And his films are an explosion of color.
Pretty fabulous.
Tell us about the narrator of your film.
I'm the narrator of the film. And when I wrote the script, I compressed a number of stories into one story so that one voice could speak for many. So it's really three or four or five stories combined, which is horrendous. I wrote a script, I wrote a story, and then I boiled it down. And how I even boiled it down to 1 minute, I have no idea. But it's pretty short, but impactful.
You use a moth metaphor.
Yeah.
and at some point you say, wombs like torn moth wings are irreplaceable. Where did the moth metaphor come from? Was that from one of the stories you read?
The story began with the idea of a butterfly and rebuilding or passing through many stages of life. And a torn butterfly wing is, it's the death of that creature. It became more relevant to use a moth. And then I looked at moths, looking for really big moths that existed on the continental United States or in North America. And the moth has a place in Native American stories as well. The moth isn't a really happy character. So there's many layers, and then I used a moth to develop my color palette as well.
You're getting very emotional talking about yourself. It's getting you to your core, just even thinking about it.
Yeah. Yes. And it is touching. But yeah. Honestly can't figure out where this comes from. I've spent many hundreds of hours on this piece, and I've written tremendous lengthy documents to describe what it is that I'm making and defending the work itself, the idea itself, and it still just catches me.
You're not desensitized to it at all after spending all that time?
Not at all.
Aside from being a woman in the 21st century, aside from watching news stories day after day after day, in which men tell us what we're supposed to be doing with our bodies and what our bodies are supposed to be for, is there anything more in your background that really makes this a passionate subject for you?
Maybe. When I was 18, I got pregnant and gave my child up for adoption. That was a hard choice, but it was a choice. And I'm really, like, if I decided not to have an abortion, I decided to carry the child to term, and I decided to give him up for adoption. And like, I think about, what if I didn't have that choice? Where would I, what would this life, my life, be if I didn't have that option? Or have options for birth control afterwards? I've also had abortions as well, because birth control wasn't working for me particularly well. And then I have also chosen to be sterilized, so that later in my life I was like, I can't have kids. I made the decision, and it has been really useful. It was a good decision for me, I should say. Not useful to me to not have kids. It was a good decision for me. I'm not parent material. I come from a hard background, so it's been like, I decided that I couldn't pass that on at all. I had to break a chain. And my brother made the same decision, honestly. So, and then recently I've had a hysterectomy. So I've gone through all of this entire process. I've walked that entire path of choices.
But you were able to consent.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were asked for consent.
I was asked for consent, and I'm solely responsible for all the decisions that I've made in my own reproductive choices. And I can't imagine not having those choices.
You're listening to Radio Zine. Today I'm speaking with Portland animator Kathy Hart about her film Torn and what motivates her to create art with political messages.
Even though you are supported in making politically motivated art, what do you feel are the challenges in the world as an artist who makes big statements about women, or makes any big statement?
No, it's not a popular subject. And I think, as someone who can, I will. The art world is still very much a man's world. And as a woman pushing into the art world, it's met with challenges. I assume, or I imagine, I guess, that gives me a certain freedom to make the work powerful work, hard-hitting work. Maybe by brute force pushes me into the art world, and by using the same tools that men use, and unapologetically be a feminist artist. I'm of the mind to believe that any woman making art is a feminist artist.
You also made a film about the Stanford marshmallow experiments.
I did.
The 60s and 70s.
I did.
Another sort of deep thinking consideration piece. Is that your goal as an artist?
I don't know that it's my goal, but it's the way I make work. It's the way I think about the world. And I honestly believe that if I weren't making work that was socially conscious, socially aware, learning us on something, teaching a lesson of some kind, or responsive or reflective of my observations of the world that we live in, then I'm not doing it right. I think it's really important to show myself through my work. I'm not an anonymous maker, and I can't even really imagine how you could make work that was void of that, or glossed over it, or masked it. And I really admire the Czech and Polish and Russian animators who drove political film and drove animation techniques through time. They're pioneers, and they managed to make incredibly political films in really wonderfully subversive ways.
What are some of your favorites?
The Tale of Tales by Yuri Norstein is really wonderful. It looks like a sweet allegory, but it's really talks about a lot of plight in Russia after a war. Pick one. I also really admire Peter Dumala. He works on slabs of plaster that have been painted black, and he scratches out the line. And so there's this really beautiful echo of his hand in the work. And he is making animated films that are specifically intended for adult audiences, which is to say, Kafka. So he's addressing adult concerns through this media that is accessible and beautiful.
So for you as an artist, you don't want to disappear.
I don't want to disappear.
During consumption.
Absolutely, no. I think it's part of the political statement, or if I'm making a political statement at all, which I have already said that I think I am, but to be present in that work is in part recognition of the human in the work. It's not machine made. I think a lot of the animated work that we consume in the general public, from the big studios, it removes the artist from the work. And we don't see the hand, we don't see the wabi-sabi, we don't see the humanity in that work, and it's glossed over. And if I were interested in studio animation and character animation, I would probably be more open to that. But I'm very decidedly more interested in experimental film and animation, where the hand of the artist, the humanity of the artist, is still present, because we are characters also, and and it didn't make itself. And I believe that it's a really nice reminder that there's a lot of people who work really hard to make these whimsical, lyrical, beautiful little films, or even big films for that matter. And to pretend we're not there is, I think, not doing anybody any justice.
Do you think that's a function of just having 1,000 people working on a Pixar movie, for example, just to name one studio?
Absolutely. Particularly on a large studio, on a feature-length film, the character animation has to be constructed in a way that 1,000 people could be working on it. We could look at Laika. Local animation studio here works in stop motion.
Laika.
And
they made Coraline.
And Pared Norman. And their stuff is beautifully constructed. And they're all 3D printed and colored, which is decidedly taking the hand out of the work. On one hand, I appreciate the fine details. And I appreciate that these people are working in huge, amazing studios to make this really great stories, these really fabulous narratives, and I have no desire to do that at all.
Your film Torn was screened at the Experimental Film Festival and the Pacific Northwest College of Art Video Fest, both of which in May. What kind of reception did you get?
Tears. People around me that recognized me while I was sitting in the theater just looked at me with total shock, like, wow, we're really? Wow. And thanks. I received appreciation for making a political work. It was well received. The feedback that I got was that I need to write a better artist statement. Because the film guide didn't say enough about the content or the process. The process was pretty intensive.
Was making this movie any kind of therapy for you?
I don't think so. The dancers I used in this film were fire dancers. I was a fire dancer for many, many years, and I found that drawing the fire dancers gave me similar repetitive motion injuries as spinning. I felt that through the process that there was a transference from the image through my body out onto the medium that I drew in and ultimately to the film. So I'm in there. Lots of painful muscles are in there. Therapy? No, I don't think so. I wish it were. I was hoping that it would be. I went in wanting to have time to consider the option or consider the topic and maybe come to some reconciliation, and I didn't find that.
Given how emotional it still makes you feel, it's still open.
It's still very open, and I have yet to determine whether that is a good place or not so great place to be, and so raw. And I, ultimately, as I am the person that I am, I want it to remain open. I don't know that I want to find closure.
What's your next project?
My next project is an experimental expanded cinema project. An expanded cinema means that there is some component that lives off the screen, that lives outside of the screen in the real world. You're not fully transported into animation as a film itself. So this film has a sculptural element that interrupts the light of the film, and the shadow from that sculpture is a character in the film.
So it's an interaction between a real-world object and projection.
And the projection. And the film, ultimately, it's about military sexual trauma and women in combat. It's also about remembrance. And it's also about resurrection.
What inspired that film?
I served in the Navy during the first Iraq war. And recent decisions about putting women into combat have brought up questions within me about how appropriate or inappropriate that is, or how we as a concerned political body will respond appropriately to women's concerns as they try to deal with and live their lives in combat with men. It's a challenging place, even not in combat, just serving day to day in the military. Women are exposed to ridiculous harassment, and it breaks people down, breaks women down. And when you try and report it, it falls on deaf ears. I heard, and women still hear and still report, things like, "Are you sure you want to file this report? Think about what it's going to do to his career." My instant response is, "What about my career? Or what about her career?" And there's a lot of talk in the news about treating and addressing military sexual trauma for both women and men. But I feel that it, and this is one of the concerns that I'm researching in this process, is how will that translate to actual policy on the ground? How will the new discussions really serve women or men who are victims of harassment and rape on a daily basis?
Sexual violence and harassment towards women in the military makes the news quite a bit, lately at least. To what extent are men subjected to those things as well?
From the research that I've done so far, I understand there's 100% harassment of women. It's actually higher than that, but we can mathematically. But men are still they're reporting about 25% as well. Men are harassed as well, and I'm very hopeful and optimistic that new policies in regards to gays in the military will help resolve some of that harassment because there's an acceptance there. But I'm optimistic and hopeful that the face of living a life in the military will be just less horrible for everybody, really. We go in hoping that, and I'm going to speak as a woman, you go into the military and you're in a unit and you have an expectation that your unit are your brothers and that they've got your back. And when you live in a unit of people who are trying to rape you or belittle you or gaslighting you on a daily basis, women are left feeling really isolated and alone and unsupported in addition to being harassed. And it's really grim.
In addition to being in combat.
In addition to being in combat. In addition to being in a stressful environment, whether it's combat or somewhere near combat or even supporting combat. Often for many women, going into the military is a way to remake themselves or to escape something or to generate the money to go to school. So this is where the resurrection comes in. A lot of people do, but I'm a woman, so I'm going to speak for women. I can't presume to speak for men. Bringing it back around, if a woman is going into the military, there's a bazillion reasons to go into the military. Often is to create independence for oneself and to operate and function as an individual. Oddly, in the military, but it works. And she's then faced with this harassment and has to live with herself and the wounds of that traumatic experience after the military. So there's this kind of trifecta of remaking herself and resurrecting herself and remembering herself.
What is the pregnancy and reproductive culture in the military like?
When I was in, as women were assigned to hazardous duty or isolated duty, women were required to sign contracts promising that they wouldn't get pregnant.
What steps does the military take to support that? I mean, do they make sure everybody's on birth control?
They provide birth control. And if you're over a certain age and have had kids already, they will provide sterilization for you as well. Back when I was in the Navy, it was assumed that if you got pregnant, you were getting out of the military, a way to process out. And by signing this contract saying that you wouldn't get pregnant, there's some recourse against your getting pregnant. So there's that kind of control, which is ridiculous.
Are men required to sign contracts saying they're not going to knock anybody up?
No. However, if a man were to request a vasectomy, it is provided. That's a decision he has to make on his own, which is great. I mean, they've got choices as well.
What do you hope to do when you graduate?
After I graduate from PNCA, I would like to go straight to grad school to study critical theory and continue in the experimental film. So these two things together, I think, are mission critical for me as an artist to continue to review how art affects the world and how I can use those tools to make messages.
This is Radio Zine. I'm Ren Green, and I've been speaking with Portland animator Kathy Hart.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8? when the door slams shut. Here on KBOO Portland.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. Do you fear a catastrophic disaster that would destroy human life on Earth? Do you know much about the Earth's past major disasters and how humans have survived? Annalee Newitz, founder of io9.com, has written a book which looks at the history of mass extinctions on Earth and what we can learn from them. The book is called Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Annalee is the founding editor of io9.com. She has written for Wired, Popular Science, and The Washington Post, and she was a Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT. Annalee Newitz, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How did you get interested in this whole area of mass extinction?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in doom and apocalypse. And I really started out, when I was first conceiving of the book, wanting to write a book about just sort of the history of how life had been destroyed on the planet. I knew that mass extinction was a big part of our geological history, and I really felt like Earth was doomed, humanity was doomed, and these huge extinctions in our past were evidence of that. And the more I read and the more I spoke with scientists and kind of immersed myself in the field, the more I realized that actually the story that comes out of mass extinction is a story of survival. And all the creatures and plants that survive these terrible scourges. And so that was really what the book came to be about, was how do you survive? How do we learn from those episodes of survival out of mass death?
Let's talk about some of the basics. What qualifies as a true mass extinction?
So there's some debate about that, but generally in the scientific community, the definition is any event where more than 75% of all species on the planet die out. So that's a huge number. You know, you have to have this, you know, enormous number of creatures and